Thank you, everybody. Hello. Glad to see you again. Is this on properly? Did I turn it on? I may not have turned it on over here. Is it on? Ah, there. Superb. Superb. Now, before I start, I've got a little, an investigation. I am so impressed with the way you sing. I mean, I haven't heard young people sing with such gusto and to sing such things. And I have a couple of questions for you because I'm interested in finding out how you learned to sing these things. First of all, how many of you can read the music that they put up here on the screen? Praise God. That is just fantastic. Now, the second question is, how did you learn? How many of you learned from church music growing up in the church? Yeah? Okay. How many of you learned from your parents? Your parents teach you to read music? Yes, some of you? Okay. How many of you learned in school, in classes and things? Yeah, a few of you then? All right, very good. Well, that's very impressive. As you probably know, maybe you don't know, a lot of evangelical churches nowadays are going to sort of popular music, and they don't even put the music on the screen. They just put the words up there. And for those of us who read music, it's almost useless, because if I don't already know the tune, then I can't have to sit there and listen to them sing it through one time and kind of get an idea of it. I can't sing the first verse of a lot of things. But if they just put the music up here like this, I could read it off, right? I'm a musician. I could do that. But they don't do that. And the other thing is, because of the fact that melodies are hard to understand if you don't have the music there and people don't read music, that means then, and they want you to sing, what they do is they sing melodies that are trivial. You see, they sing ones that are easily predictable. You get it in 2 seconds. And there are a lot of cliches, musical cliches that people pick up on. And the effect that it has on us is that we get into a rut of doing real, it's, what's the equivalent? Let me think about. Let's say all you'd ever eaten in your life was cotton candy. Your whole life, okay? And somebody came along and said, you know, there are other foods. There are other things. And you might say, you might be tempted to say, no, I don't want that. Thank you. I'm not interested. See? This is what I know. This is what I'm comfortable with. And you miss out on so much. But that's how it is with music, too. And I'm so grateful for my friend James in the last lecture. It's just wonderful to hear him and his enthusiasm for numbers and the beauty of numbers. If you can catch even a little glimpse of that, you'll really go far. But it's because he's opening your eyes to things like that. Like if you've never learned the language of numbers, then you won't know how to understand and appreciate. Just like if you've never learned how to read music, you won't know how much you're missing, as it were, you know. So anyway, kudos to you for learning how to read and for being able to read those parts. I was so excited to hear people singing the other parts. You've got tenors and basses and altos out there, and it's just wonderful. So, does my little conductor's heart joy. All right, now my job today is to talk to you a little bit about a very fine example of Gothic architecture. One of the wonderful things about the Middle Ages, you know, as Protestants, we often think that the Middle Ages were backward and screwed up and theologically inept and a lot of corruption and all that's true. I would say the same thing today, tell you the truth. Most of us are living in a fallen world, and things are never the way they're supposed to be. So, but the great thing about the Middle Ages, there's some things that were really great about the Middle Ages, but the one great thing about the Middle Ages is that they had an understanding of something called medieval synthesis. Have you ever heard of that phrase before? Medieval synthesis. It was this understanding that that reality was in two parts. Reality is in the physical world, the visible material world, and reality is in this invisible world that I was talking about yesterday morning. And so the two of them have to be understood in some kind of relationship, in harmony with each other, you see? So if you really want to be able to understand the invisible world and see the invisible world, you have to be able to see it through the visible world. And so they synthesize the spiritual and the material. They synthesize the horizontal and the vertical. They synthesize individual with the body of Christ. They were thinking, how can I harmonize things that seem disparate, seem different? How can stone speak of God? Well, it can, it turns out. In fact, some people say that cathedrals like the one I'm about to show you I can't think of the right word. Example, maybe, of, you know, when Jesus was coming into Jerusalem and the crowds were cheering and people told him, shut your people up, you know, tell them not to do that. And he said, if they don't shout out, if they don't praise me, the stones themselves will cry out, will sing out. And some people say that cathedrals like this are the example of stone crying out the glory of God. So I want to show you, because a lot of times in our day, people have never seen this kind of example of church architecture. Now, there were three things, before I get into it, three things that the medievals understood about beauty. The first one you heard a lot about with James just now, that is quantity. They loved the relationship of numbers and orders and balances and symmetries and ratios and proportions and all of that. So quantities evaluated. The second one was quality. And the beauty of quality is seen, they thought, in light. Light has a glorious quality to it. And I'll come back to that in a second. And the third of the three was symbolism. That is, this thing can stand in for that thing. So you carve this way in order to reflect something about that invisible thing, you see. So things can be metaphorically related, like we were talking about yesterday morning. So quantity, quality, and symbol, those three. And I want you to think about those as I pop through a few slides. Can we run the lights down up here so that they can see these pictures as clearly as possible? This is... A lot of people think that the cathedral called Notre Dame, in French, Our Lady, is in Paris. But the reality is all of these cathedrals in northern France were dedicated to Notre Dame, that is, Mary. And so they're all called Notre Dame, just so you know. And that's why, especially with other cities, not so much in Paris, but with other cities, the architects won't talk about the building as Notre Dame, which is the name of it, obviously, but they'll say Chartres, the city of Chartres, where this Notre, so it's Notre Dame de Chartres, you see? So there's Notre Dame de Rheims, and Notre Dame de Rouen, and Notre Dame de Paris. So they'll say, when they talk about the cathedral in Paris, they won't call it Notre Dame. They'll call it Paris. So this is Notre Dame de Chartres, or just Chartres. How many of you speak French? You speak French? Ah oui, bien, bien. Okay, so this is the building. Now, it's on a hill. You know, I put this slide thing together many years ago to talk about it, but it's built for like an hour and a half lecture. So I'm going to just like speed through some because I don't have all the time. So forgive me if I go quickly. But this is the building, and if you see it's up on a hill. And, you know, pilgrims would come from miles and miles away walking to Chartres to worship at Chartres. And all around the city are fields. It's all very flat. And the city itself is up on a hill. So they said that you could see the building from 3 days' walk away. So you walk toward it for 3 days before you get there. And you see it getting bigger and bigger. It's a little like Emerald City in The Wizard of Oz. You know, you see it off in the distance and it gets bigger and bigger. It's like that. Well, Notre Dame is is an interesting building to study because in the Middle Ages there were two different kinds of styles, one called Romanesque style and one called Gothic style. The Romanesque is earlier, the Gothic is later. Well, this building was built at the very beginning of the Gothic period, and so it has some Gothic characteristics. But then it burned down, or part of it did, and it was rebuilt, 60, 70 years later. And when they rebuilt it in the more advanced Gothic style. So you can see two different styles in the same building. So I want to give you a quick tour of what the Romanesque building would look like. This is a typical Romanesque building. Can you see how very, very thick walls, rounded arches, sort of stubby looking towers like this, not as tall, and there are no what they call flying buttresses. This is the French Romanesque, and this eventually gets taken in, what happens in 1066? Anybody know? Battle of Hastings, and who wins? The French do. So the Normans brought this kind of architecture into southern England, and they call it, in southern England, they call it Norman style. But that's it. These are some of the ones that are in the style of that. Well, you don't need to know about all this. So this is the French Gothic, however, because this is Chartres Cathedral, and it has, if you look on the right-hand side, you see a more plain tower. That's the earlier tower. And you on the left, a more Gothic, high Gothic tower. And the one on the left is built after the fire. So in the Gothic style, you have things like these high spires, far thinner walls, pointed arches, a lot more light in the building. And I'm going to tell you about why that is in just a second. Some of the famous Gothic buildings are Saint-Denis. That's the first of the great Gothic buildings, built by a fellow called Abbot Suger in 1140. And Chartres here is 1145 and then rebuilt in 1194. Paris itself, the Notre-Dame de Paris, is 1163. By the way, I was in Paris the other day when it was burning. Did you all hear about Notre-Dame having the fire and so on? Well, we were there when it was going on. We had just gone through it the week before. Rheims is another. And then in England, you begin to see Gothic buildings in England, too, in the 13th century, in particular Westminster Abbey. Anybody been to Westminster Abbey? Aha, super. Okay, well, these are what they call flying buttresses. This is unique to the Gothic style. These are buttresses, things that come up out of the ground, great heavy stone feet, as it were, and then a flyer that goes through, basically arcs through the air and touches the side of the building to hold the wall up. Now, the question I've got for you here is, why would you need to do this? Well, it goes back to those three things I was talking about. Number, light, and metaphor or symbol. If you've got a Romanesque building, you understand, first of all, you have to understand that these buildings were built without any steel reinforcing, right? They're all stone when they're original. There's no steel in them. And so the stone actually has to hold the roof up. And the roof, as you can imagine, is extremely heavy. Well, if you have a roof, the gravity is pulling it down, right? Well, as it pulls it down, it pushes on the walls of the building and makes the walls want to go like this, right? Because the peaked roof like this is pressing down on them. Well, that means you've got to build extremely thick and heavy walls to hold that roof up. And that's typical of the Romanesque period. Well, Abbot Suger, building Saint-Denis, decided what he really wanted was light inside the building. You see, if you have huge thick walls, the windows are terribly thick. You can't get sunlight into the building. And they didn't have electric lights. So even in the daytime, inside a Romanesque building, it's pretty dark. So what he wanted to do was symbolize God inside the building. And the symbol for God was light. The glory of the quality of light. And so, in order to get light into the building, you had to do several things. You had to make the walls thinner, and you had to make the roof higher, because the higher you go, the more likely the angle of the sun will get the sun into the building, right? But at the same time that you make the roof higher, you're increasing the weight. And that when you increase the weight, you need a thicker wall, don't you? And that's the same time he wanted to try and thin the wall so he could put windows in there, you see? So what's he going to do? This is it. This is the accomplishment. Well, this and one other thing. Typical of a Romanesque arch is that it's round like that. And there's only so much height you can get out of a round arch without moving the legs further and further apart. But what Suger figured out was that if you point the arch like this, you can keep the legs close together and go much higher. So he figured, I can raise the height of the building, and with these buttresses, I can thin the walls of the building and put windows in there, see, and yet still hold these very high roofs up. So it was a brilliant move, practically speaking, but the purpose of it was to be able to get light inside the building. So, let me tell you a few more things about the building. First of all, cathedrals are built in the shape of a cross, what they call cruciform. And if you look down on top of it like this, see the flying buttresses down here? But if you look down on top of the actual shape of the building, it's in the shape of a cross. And they point the building always to the east. Now, why would they do that? Well, for the rising sun, that's an interesting thought. They actually take that into consideration. But from Europe, Jerusalem is east. And so they point the cathedral toward Jerusalem. The head of the cross goes east, generally speaking. Okay, a few degrees off here and there, but that's the point. So you can actually orient yourself. If you don't have a compass, you can orient yourself by way of the cathedral. Just a couple of quick examples of the differences between Romanesque work and Gothic work. This is a Romanesque capital, and you can see the figures up there. This is Eve on the left with an apple in her hand, you see, and Adam on the right, and he's got his hand up here. Do you see it like that? He's got his hand up like this. I'll tell you about why that is later on. That's typical symbolism. But all I want you to see here is, look at the quality of the work, the kind of work it is, and look at the difference between that and the high Gothic statue. Look at that. Elegant and noble and far more realistic, even though they're kind of long and elongated like that. Their faces are with character and nobility. Far, far different. Here's another wondrous set of statues on outside of Chartres. The two ladies on the left are Mary and Elizabeth meeting. Sadly, I think Mary's hands have broken off, but that's up close, that's what they look like. Look at those faces. Aren't they marvelous? This was carved in 1200 A.D. Go back to the orientation. Somebody mentioned that the sun rises in the east. Let's say that's the east. I don't know that it is, but let's say it is. And the cathedral is pointing that way. So the foot of the cross is down here. The head of the cross is up there. And the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, right? Okay. Well, in the northern hemisphere, the sun not only doesn't go just right directly over your head. If you're on the equator, it would do that. But if you're north of the equator, then the sun is actually off by a degree, a bit, right? And so it rises in the east, and it goes across, and it sets in the west like that. But it's not directly up and down. It's over here, right? So that means that on the north side of the building, there's never any direct sunlight. Even in the summertime, when the sun gets the highest in the sky, it's always going to be slightly to the south side. So on the northern side, where there's a portal and all these statues, you only get indirect sunlight. But on the south side, on the south portal, you get direct sunlight. So what did they do? They put mostly Old Testament figures on the north portal, and they put New Testament figures on the south portal. Now, why would they do that? Well, because once Jesus has come into the world, they've seen the light directly. The Old Testament sees the light, in a sense, indirectly. Do you see? So take a look at these guys. See if you can tell me who they are by what they look like. You can always tell by what they're holding or where they're standing or whatever. Can you see this fellow on the far left? He's got a cup in his hand, and he's got a censer. Do you know what a censer is? Burns incense. And in the sort of high churches, they'll have a censer like this, and smoke comes out of the censer, and represents the prayers of the saints. So who would have a cup and a censer? What's that? Aaron. That's not bad. That's not bad. No, that's not Aaron. It's before even Aaron. Who's the very first priest? We have Melchizedek. Good job. Exactly right. That's who that is on the far left. Now, who's the next guy over? Abraham. Why do you say Abraham? Good for you. That's right. See the boy in front of him? His hands are tied. And you can't tell. I think it's broken off. But in Abraham's right hand is the butt of a knife. He's going to sacrifice Isaac. But look how he's not looking at you. Do you see where he's looking? He's looking up and to the right like that. What's he looking at? Well, look in the capital over Melchizedek. There's a little face. Do you see him? He's got wings, too. He's an angel. Do you see him? And Abraham is looking up there to the angel, and the angel is pointing down like this at his feet. Can you see what's down here? It's a ram. So this statue tells the entire story of the sacrifice of Isaac in one fell swoop, as it were. He's about to sacrifice Isaac, and he looks up. The angel says, no, there's the ram in the thicket. Sacrifice him instead, you see. And the whole thing is right there. Next to him, you might see a guy with a tablet in his hand. You see the stone tablet? That's Moses, right? And then next to him, the last two people are historians debate about. I think it's David. He's as a shepherd. He's got a lamb in his hands, but he's also got a beard. So it's a little weird to think that may be him, but might be. And then Solomon on the far right, the king with the spear in his hands and all that. But some people debate about those last two. But anyway, they're all Old Testament figures. Well, take a look at these and look at the light. OK, take a look at the light on this side. It's indirect light. Now look on the south portal at the light. You see it? The heavy shadows, the hard shadows. That's direct light. And all of these guys are the apostles. And you can tell which is which a little bit by, I think this is Paul here on the left. And the reason they say that is because they say he was bald, that he had missing hair. And the one next to him, can you tell who that might be? It's a little more obscure. It's John. And the reason it's John is that John was the youngest of them all, right? And they always depict John without a beard. So he's the young one, see? And the others are other of the disciples. Now, I'm going to pop through this quickly. This is a typical Romanesque rounded arch tympanum. They call that a tympanum in the area above the portal there. And then this is typical of an early Gothic one. You see how it's more pointed? Well, as it goes, it gets increasingly pointed. I'm going to come back to this particular portal in a minute because I want you to see what's in it. Here are some of the statues in that portal. This on the left, you see an angel. Sadly, of course, their hands are broken off and some things are missing and so on. But here's an angel and speaking to a woman. So what story would that be? The Annunciation, they call it, right? The angel coming to Mary. And then next to them, two women talking to each other. So that's Mary and Elizabeth, you see. On the other side, you see this wonderful little story. Uh-oh, what happened? Did I go too far? There we go. Here's another angel, sadly without a head. But look who he's talking to. Can you tell? Who? Not Joseph. Shepherds. Can you see the little sheep? There are little sheep across the bottom. They're all shepherds. And one of them is going, like this. And then look at this guy. He's going, oh! It's wonderful. These were sculpted in 1200 or so, around 1200. Isn't that amazing? That's the story. Okay, I want to tell you a little bit about the liberal arts, because this Chartres was what they call a cathedral school. The university is a Christian invention, and it's built on the curriculum that was taught in what they call cathedral schools. Cathedral schools would teach boys, sorry girls, it was just boys back then, they would teach them the seven liberal arts that they got mostly from the Greeks, but they interpret it through a Christian filter. And so you get the trivium and the quadrivium. Who can tell me what the trivium is? Grammar? Logic? Rhetoric. Excellent. That's right. And what about the quadrivium? Music is one of them. Geometry? Astronomy, somebody said? And arithmetic. You were getting some of this, actually, in the last lecture. So those are the seven things that were being taught at the cathedral schools. Now, what I want you to see is this portal. They call it the Seven Arts Portal. This is Jesus seated in the lap of Mary. Mary enthroned in heaven. You know, the Romans call her the Queen of Heaven. So in heaven, he's seated in her lap. She's got the crown on her head. He's got a crown on his head. And on either side are angels. And on the outside of that tympanum, they call that centerpiece, you see, well, look at this fellow right here. Can you see how he's got wings on his back? Can you see the wings? Maybe hard to see in the back. But those are wings, and all of them in that archivolt, they call it, are angels. So here's Jesus enthroned and angels around him worshiping. So far, so good. But look at the outside archivolt. Look at this guy here. He doesn't have any wings. He's got a little desk in his lap, and he's working. Well, he's a man. And if you look at the rest of them, let me show you a couple more. All around that external archivolt are alternating women, a woman and a man, and a woman and a man, and a woman and a man, like that. And the woman, in each case, is the personification of the liberal art. Grammar, logic, rhetoric, etc. And just below the woman is a little man working, and it's the man that's most closely associated in their minds with that art. So let me go back to the first one. Maybe I can show you exactly who they are. This one down here at the bottom is the woman logic. And it's, maybe I've got better pictures along the way. The one above her, though, is rhetoric. Two up, at the very top is rhetoric, the woman rhetoric. And below her is Cicero, the great Roman rhetorician. On the other side, you see, can you see one woman there in the very center with her head kind of bent up like this? That's astronomy. And below her is Ptolemy, the astronomer. And below him is, you can see the face down here, is grammar. Let me see if I can show you music. Oh, yeah, here's the woman music. Can you see in her hands she's got a kind of a harp and a hammer, and she's banging a bell? Well, and next, I guess over here is a monochord. If you don't know what a monochord is, that's all right. There's an early viol there, a kind of violin-like figure thing. And she is representing music. And below her is, who do you associate with music? Beyonce. No, wait. No, not Beyonce. Pythagoras. Pythagoras. Who would think a mathematician would be associated with music? But that's what music was for, is to understand math. The trivium is about grammar, logic, and rhetoric, which is about how to understand words. Remember, I said this yesterday morning. The quadrivium is about numbers, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. And it's the trivium is so that you can unlock special revelation, the Bible. The quadrivium is so that you can unlock the natural world around you and see the general revelation of God in the world. Well, they needed to have these skills, these liberal arts skills, in order to be able to make sense of God. Here is a statue. Here's the woman, Logic. You can see her in her left hand. She has a torch. Logic is a way of enlightening things. But in her right hand, she has a creature that looks like it's kind of half dragony, half snaky, and she's having trouble holding him. He's difficult to grasp. And that's logic. Logic is enlightening and it's difficult. And maybe even dangerous. And below her is the great logician, Aristotle. That's Aristotle. Here is, this is one of my favorites. This is grammar. This is a woman grammar. In her hand, she has a book. In her left hand, she has a book. See what she has in her right hand? Those are switches. That's for discipline. And look at the boys. She's got two boys down here with books in their hands. And one of them is reaching across and pulling the hair of the other one. You see? Some things never change. So she's got to discipline them, and grammars for the young ones. And here below her is the grammarian Donatus. And here's astronomy I told you about, and Ptolemy. So you get the idea. All of the seven arts are actually represented there. And what I want to show you is, in the minds of the Middle Ages, Chartres Cathedral School, and eventually the early university, there was absolutely no disconnect between worshiping Jesus and reading Aristotle. Worshiping Jesus and reading Donatus. Worshiping Jesus and reading Pythagoras. You see? Pythagoras and Aristotle in particular were long before Jesus ever reigned, right? Ever lived. So, but in their minds, the truth is the truth is the truth, and this is where you can get hold of it. So all things that are true need to be a tympanum like this that shows that they too bow down to Jesus, just like all those angels do. It's all about him. Okay, inside the church, I won't go through all these things. This is this is the inside of a Romanesque nave, they call it, a nave, and you see a barrel vault up there. See how the rounded arches turn into a vault? But a Gothic vault uses pointed arches like this, you see? And so that's the difference, again, between the Romanesque and the Gothic. And I want you to see this because I think that might be... No, that's an old shot of Chartres, but they've been cleaning Chartres. See how dark and gray it all looks up there? This is what that same place looks like now. Isn't that marvelous? They've cleaned it, painstakingly cleaned it, and painted it, all these beautiful colors. It's really stunning. In this, you can see the part that's been redone and the part that hasn't been redone, you see? That's right at the cross piece of the nave and the transept, the part that goes north-south. They say that all that dark is because of centuries of candle wax. Can you imagine? They've put candles in there since 1145. So, oh, can I tell you just one thing about Notre Dame Paris? Everybody's eyes were focused on Paris when it burned the other day, and a real tragedy. Hopefully they'll be able to rebuild it. It'd be interesting to see what they do. But it occurred to me that you could try to get an idea of how old these buildings are. We don't understand old in this country very well. We've only been around for a couple hundred years, right? 240 years. Well, it dawned on me that you could fit the entire history of the United States from July 4th, 1776 to today, between the time that Notre Dame de Paris was founded and the birth of Joan of Arc. Now, Joan of Arc was 600 years ago. But you can fit the entire history of the United States between the time that it was founded and when Joan of Arc was born. Imagine that. That's how old that building is. 1163. Okay. Now, there are some fantastic windows, and I want to tell you about one set of them. I'll show you a few just so you can see them. But I want to show you how to read a window, how these guys understood windows. This is a rose window. I think maybe James showed you a rose. It's hard to see it in this slide, but this is a rose up there. It's about the diameter of that circle up there is probably half again as high as from the floor to the ceiling here. It's massively tall. And these are called lancet windows on either side, partly because they look like the point of a spear. You see a lance, these straight up ones. Well, I'm going to tell you about one of those. I'm going to skip over the Joseph window. Maybe I can get all this in before. We quit at 11:30, right? Is that correct? Okay. All right. This is what they call the Joseph window that I'm flashing through. Tells the whole story of Joseph. You start in these windows, you start at the lower left-hand corner and you read to the right and then up instead of going down. You start at the lower corner and you read across and then you go up and you read across and then you go up and you read across like that. And I'm going to show you the Good Samaritan window. The Good Samaritan window in diagram looks like this, and you start down here and you read across, and then you go to 4, and then 5, 6, 7, and then 8, and then 9, 10, 11, like that. So let's talk about this window a little bit. Centerpieces, flowery-looking pieces, 1, 2, 3 of them, are called quatrefoils. You can imagine why. They have 4 petals to them. And they look like that in the window. And I'm going to show you close-up so you can see what's actually in there. But just so you see the shape of the entire window, that's the very bottom of it. And the first quatrefoil. And the middle of it, like that. And then the top of it, like that. Well, across the bottom, you get the guilds represented that actually paid for the window. In the Middle Ages, they had sort of unions. They had guilds. That would teach stonework or window work, or maybe they do carpentry or shoemaking or baking or whatever. All these, the various sort of trades that people would learn, and they would pass them on to their children and so on. Well, across the bottom of the window, you see the shoemakers. They actually gave the money for this window, and so you see shoemakers at work. That's sort of the way they signed the window, you see. But then the first part of the window that looks like a story is this. And in it, you see Jesus on the right with a halo there and his blessing. That's a sort of symbol of a blessing that he gives. And he's teaching and he's talking to these fellows on the left. Well, if you know the story of the Good Samaritan, they come to him and they ask him, who is my neighbor? And he tells the story of the Good Samaritan, and he tells it like this. You all know the story, but I'm going to show you the pictures and tell you the story at the same time. To begin with, a man is going from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he falls among robbers. And they beat him, and they strip him of his clothes, and they leave him for dead. And who should come along but a priest on the left, and sees him and goes on by on the other side. And then a Levite on the right comes along and he passes him by on the other side. But a Samaritan arrives and has pity on the man and binds up his wounds. Here's the Samaritan on the left. And he puts him on his own donkey and takes him to the inn. And the inn looks like this. This is the innkeeper. And so the donkey is being led toward the inn there. And then the man is kept in the inn. He heals up. And the Samaritan says, here's some money, and I'm going to go away, and I'm going to come back, and I'll pay him for all that he owes. Well, that's only halfway up the window. And then it's like a gear shift. You suddenly are in a whole new story. And here you have God on the right, creating Adam. This is making him out of the dust of the ground. And then you see Adam in the garden. And then you see Adam asleep and God making Eve out of Adam. You see how he's drawing her out of his side? And then above that you have God on the left and Adam and Eve on the right and the infamous tree in between them. And he's going, see the tree? Not this one. Right? The next bit is this, where you have them eating of the tree. Here's Eve on the left with the fruit in her hands. And Adam on the right. And again, he's got his hand up like this. You see this hand up there like that next to his neck? Well, do you know why that is? Anybody know? Well, tradition was that when Adam ate the fruit, it got stuck in his throat. And that's why men have an Adam's apple. And women don't. And so he's got his hand like this. He's choking on the fruit, see? So Adam is almost always depicted like that in the Middle Ages with when you have depict him eating the fruit. Well, then, of course, they want to try and create clothes for themselves. So here they are sewing together fig leaves and trying to make clothes. And God appears and says, Adam, where are you? And there he is up in the corner, you see. And then here's the horror. On the left is the garden with the beautiful flowers. You see the big red plants and healthy plants on the left. And an angel with a sword. You see the red sword going vertical up and down like this? And he's throwing them out of the garden. They're being expelled. And on the right, you see the plants are all brown. Isn't that interesting? So they're going out into the wasteland. Out of the garden. And that is just about the end of the thing, except for this one, where you have Cain killing Abel. This is the first murder. And then finally, at the very top of the window, you have Jesus enthroned with the world in his hands and his blessing like this, but he's also in judgment. He's looking down on the rest of the window and making judgment. And that's the window. Now, the question is this. Why on earth would they put the Good Samaritan story and the creation of Adam and Eve and the fall in the same window? Has anybody ever heard of those two stories together before? Well, it turns out it's not just at Chartres that they have these two stories together. There are other cathedrals in the neighborhood within the 150-mile radius or so, and they have the same two stories in a window together. Those two stories actually went together in their minds. Well, I did a little research about it, listened to some very wise people, and read some early fathers, and I got their interpretation. And I want to go back and give it to you. This is why. Let me say this first. Whenever I've heard about the Good Samaritan story, it's been the question is, who is my neighbor? And shouldn't I be more like the Samaritan who took care of this man than the priest or the Levite who didn't pay attention to him? And that's a good story. That's true. A good interpretation. I think that's in the story. So I'm not going to take away from that. But I think there's another layer that's even deeper than that. And this is what these windows taught me. Every detail in the story of the Good Samaritan actually is important. It's not random. So, for example, a man was going from Jerusalem to Jericho. Why Jerusalem and why Jericho? If you know anything about the topography of Israel, Jerusalem is up on a hill. It's the city on a hill, right? Jericho is down in the plains to the east. So, a man going from Jerusalem to Jericho is by nature, by essential, going downhill. He's declining. And so, it can't be a man was going from Jericho to Jerusalem, do you see? It meant something. Well, what did it mean? Well, it tells you that the man has turned his back on the city of God and he's going away from God. And he's going downhill. He's declining as he goes. So the man who's going from Jerusalem to Jericho is the sinner. He's you and me. And when he falls into sin, when he turns his back on the city of God, he falls among robbers who beat him and leave him for dead. That's his state. In his sinful state, he's unable to save himself. He's in need of help. Well, who should come along but a priest? Not a butcher or a baker or a candlestick maker, but a priest. Why a priest? Well, a priest represents the sacrificial system, the Old Testament sacrificial system. And the reason that he goes by on the other side is because he can't help the man. Not because he's heartless, cruel, but because he doesn't have what the man needs. The sacrificial system can't do it completely for him. Well, who else should come along but a Levite? Well, who's a Levite? A Levite represents the law. The book of Leviticus is the book of the law. And the reason he can't help the man is because the law can't save him. So the sacrificial system can't save him in his state of sin, and the law can't save him. It can point out to him what's wrong with him, but it can't actually fix the problem, you see? Well, who should come along then but a Samaritan? Now, who is a Samaritan? A Samaritan, the Jews believed, was a half-breed. A Samaritan was a second-rate Jew. They worshipped in the wrong spot. You remember the woman at the well that Jesus talks to? She's a Samaritan woman. And the disciples, when they see him talking to her, say, "Why are you talking to her? She's a Samaritan. She's second rate. You shouldn't even bother with her." He loved her. He cared for her. He knew about her. Well, so a Samaritan then represents the person that the Jews hated. So who is that? That's Jesus. He describes himself in the parable, describes himself as somebody that they despised. The guy that they didn't want to be the hero turns out to be the hero. So what does he do? I love this story at this point because what it says is he sees the man and has pity on him. Thank God for the pity that he has on us in our fallen state, that he loves us anyway, that he loves us in spite of ourselves. He loves us when he doesn't need to love us at all. We don't deserve any of his pity, but he has it. Praise be to God. And what does he do? He binds up his wounds so he won't die. He won't be completely lost. And then, what does he say? Go and have a happy life. No. He says, you know what you need? You need to get to the inn. And for the medievals, the inn represented the church. What you need to do is get someplace where it's safe. Sanctuary, where you can heal up, you can be with like-minded Christians and so on. So he doesn't say, run over there to that inn. He says, I will provide for you the strength. I'm going to put you on my donkey. I'm going to provide the transportation, and I'm going to get you where you need to be. And so he takes him on his own donkey, it says, to the inn, where the innkeeper, see how Jesus is reaching out. The Samaritan's reaching out with his right hand there. Well, he's reaching out to this picture. You see how he's reaching toward the innkeeper? They're coming together. The innkeeper is on the right. And so the innkeeper takes him in. And then I thought to myself, as I was reading this and hearing about it from Malcolm Miller, who gives tours of Chartres, English-speaking tours, has for the last 55 years, I think. I was thinking, this is a sort of coincidental interpretation of this parable so far. But then something hit me. There's a detail at the end that I couldn't explain any other way. Do you remember what happens at the end? He gives the innkeeper some coins. But then he does something very strange. Why is this here? He says, I'm going away, but I'm coming back. And when I come back, I'll pay for whatever he owes. That's the second coming. Why is that detail in the story? I think it's why. Now, here's another reason why I think this interpretation has some gravity. If you go back to Luke, is it Luke 11 or 12? 11, I think. Anyway, it's only gospel that has this story in it is Luke. When you read it, The section that talks about the Good Samaritan starts not with who is my neighbor. A man came to Jesus and said, who is my neighbor? And so Jesus told the story. You got to go back about 5-6 verses, and it says a man who wanted to trip Jesus up, a teacher of the law, wanted to come and trip Jesus, catch him out. And so he asked him, good master, what must I do to be saved? And then Jesus said, well, keep the law. And he said, well, which law? Jesus said, love God, love your neighbor. And he says, well, who is my neighbor? Thinking I can catch him in this, you see. So then he tells the story, the parable. And at the end, he says, so who was his neighbor? And the man has to say, well, the Samaritan was the good neighbor, clearly. And he says, you've decided right. That you've answered correctly. That's right. Go and do that. But I think the parable answers the first question. The question, what must I do to be saved? And the medievals who put this window together thought that way. They said, here's the fall. The answer to the fall is the Good Samaritan parable. Isn't that interesting? I'd never thought of those two stories together until I saw this. And now I can't think of them as separate. So, he represents the grace of God and the sacrifice that God makes on our behalf to save us. Now, I was going to say, I did a little reading in some of their church fathers, and they all agreed that this was the way to interpret this parable. Isn't that interesting? They all thought that way. Then I read Calvin, and Calvin said he didn't like that interpretation. And I read, why? Why do you suppose he is? He said he didn't have any problems with the interpretation at all, it turned out, except for one thing. And he said, it doesn't work because the man isn't completely dead. Well, okay, but I wanted to say, but Jean, it's a parable. See, it's telling the story, but it's not exactly right. You know, you can't ask it to be everything. But you understand why he would say that, because unless you're completely dead, there's still a chance that you could save yourself. At least you can think you could. But the truth of the matter is you can't save yourself, and we're throwing ourselves on the mercy of God, right? Okay, well, if he had died altogether, fine. Then it would have been perfect in his mind. But, of course, the rest of the story wouldn't have worked as well. So, but I thought it was very interesting that he didn't have any problem with this more sort of analogical, metaphorical kind of interpretation of the thing himself. So even Calvin didn't disagree with it, with interpreting the rest of it the way he did. So that was very interesting to me. But it's an interpretation that I haven't heard anybody else teach ever. And I only got it from a 12th century, early 13th century window. I have time for one last story about Shark before I quit. It turns out that in the Second World War, you all know D-Day is the 75th anniversary of D-Day is this week. What's today? Is it today the 5th or 6th? 5th, so is it tomorrow? June 6, 1944, D-Day happened. It was a tremendous accomplishment, never matched, as far as I know, in all of warfare. But the Allies' forces landed in Normandy, right, and started to work their way inland. And as they worked inland, they were headed toward the inland of France, right? And Chartres is about, an hour and a half by train south, west and slightly south of Paris. So they were going to be going through Chartres as they came through fighting the Nazis. Well, the story goes that as they approached the town of Chartres, they were being shelled really mercilessly by the German soldiers, German artillery. And the leadership of the Allies decided that they must be sighting their artillery from the towers of Chartres Cathedral. And they couldn't have that because they were getting pounded. And so they gave the order to demolish Chartres by artillery. They wanted to knock it down so that they couldn't use it against them. And there was an American, I think he was a captain. I forget, maybe he was only a sergeant, but I think he was a captain. Texas, from Texas. I don't remember his name. But there was this fellow who went to the leadership, to the generals, and said, hang on a second, give me one day and let me prove that that's actually the case before you knock this old building down. And they gave him the chance. So that's what it was. He is a captain because he took a sergeant with him. There were two of them. And that night they snuck through the German lines into the town of Chartres. And they went to the cathedral and they snuck into the cathedral and up the bell towers. Each moment, you know, if anybody were to make an alarm, anybody catch them, they'd be killed immediately. Snuck in there, climbed all the way up to the top of the bell towers, and they found out there were no Nazis there. They weren't using the towers at all. So they snuck back down again and out and back through the German lines, weren't caught, and reported back to the American, to the Allied forces, that they weren't using Chartres as an artillery target site. And because of that, the Allies didn't shell the building, and it stands today. Amen. And I'm told, I haven't seen it myself, but I'm told in the town of Chartres, someplace, there is a plaque in the ground, in a park or in a street or something, with this man's name and thanks from the whole town for not knocking down this beautiful building. The story also goes, this captain was a tank commander, and the next day they went into battle in their tanks, and he was killed. The people of Chartres, knowing that the Allies were coming, decided that they would take apart all of these windows. In Chartres, there must be 115 or so windows. And they're big. It's like I told you, that huge rose. There are three massive roses. But then there are these incredible lancet windows all around the building. All the highest quality of medieval window making. And they went in and they took them all down piece by piece. And they wrapped them up carefully, and they hid them in the crypt under the building, under the cathedral, and in homes all throughout the town. Because they were afraid that the explosions and the war and so on would shatter all these windows. Even if not a direct hit, a close hit might break these windows. They're very delicate. So after the war, they took them all out and they put them all back up again. And that's another reason why this building is one of the great ones to study if you're interested in medieval architecture, because they have the greatest collection of original 12th century, 13th century windows in all of France. So, all right, all of this is to say that it's possible for us to get a glimpse of new things through the material, things that are invisible through the material. And so I think of this Chartres window of the Good Samaritan as a great example of that. You should go and see the building, see the shape of it, see the way the statues are laid out, see the stories that are told in all the windows, and learn greatly from it. Because you understand that at the time, people were not as anywhere near as literate as we are today. Being able to read was a rare thing. And so the stories of the Bible were often taught by way of these windows and these statues. Okay. Thanks for your attention. Have a great lunch.